Hello, dear listeners. This is Dialogia, Dialogy. I'm struggling with this. Dialogia, Dialogy, a podcast about social sciences, scientists, and the people and the communities that we study. I am Maria Muroma-Mengel. I'm working as an associate professor of media studies at the University of Tartu, and I will be your host. And for those who have been with us for previous seasons, I have some very good news for you guys. Guess who's back?
Back again. Shady's back. Oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. Hi.
Hi, Maija Klaassen, you're back from Italy. Ciao, bella. How was it?
Tutti. It was magical, beautiful, but kind of like a dream after being back for a month now. Like old news. Let's move on.
Well, we will have to talk about this separately, because today we have the pleasure of having a guest from far away.
Far away land.
Far away land. We have Nathalie van Rijmdonk.
Perfect.
Who is a PhD researcher at the Vrije Universiteit in media and communication sciences. Hello.
Hello, Maria. Vrije Universiteit Brussels, by the way.
Yeah, sorry.
Locating.
Sorry. I always forget something.
Just say, you want to be heard, you are a Belgian. We hear you loud and clear.
Yes, proud Belgian.
Before I even let us get anywhere with our talks and to talk about your topic and everything like that, we need a safe word because scientists tend to get into their topics like hardcore, and then they close their eyes and they start to talk in a really, really passionate way, and nobody understands what they're saying. So we need a safe word that me and Maija can gently yell at you when you forget yourself that you need to talk like a human being.
Banana.
Banana.
Do you want to explain yourself?
No, it's just, I don't know, it's a banana.
Do you think that there's a reason why we should be talking about bananas, like for some other reason?
No, absolutely not. I'm sorry, it's very random. I wish I had a proper
thing. This is an internet culture thing, because I was immediately thinking about Banana for Measure, you know, where there was this whole series that they put bananas everywhere
bananas
to
for
show
scale.
Sorry, that's the word.
No, it's the same. It's the
potato, potato.
I have a dancing banana in front of me, like from a meme or something like that. Okay, enough about bananas.
Also, banana works in almost every language.
Yes, it does. Let's kick off with general topics. Let's talk about the world, how we are, what's happening, and so on. So, Nathalie, what's the problem?
Is there a problem? I see no problem.
I don't know. Is there a problem?
This is fine.
Meme people.
Yes, I wonder how many people are going to catch all the memes. Should maybe have a counter if you want to drink while we're doing this. Like, have shots every time. You're like, that. I think that's a meme. So the meme is the man in the house, like the dog with the everything is on fire around him. And the dog goes, this is fine.
This is fine, absolutely.
And it was the Ukrainian Defense Forces that also tweeted this when they got invaded. I think, it was the official Ukraine Twitter account.
Nice. Yep.
Yeah. This is fine. So, you are a disinfo researcher. What types of disinfo are you interested in? What are you working with?
I mean, what I'm mostly interested in is how we shape disinfo, how people kind of spread disinfo. And so, for me, disinfo is more like the byproduct of just humans interacting with each other, humans, being stupid with each other and potentially not correcting each other and talking to each other. So the type of disinfo that I'm interested in, misinfo maybe more, is really the kind where it's like, hey, have you heard? Mm-hmm. So the rumors, the witch hunts, the type of misinfo where it just kind of spreads. I mean, the WhatsApp killings where it's like, hey, there was a man who raped a child in the village. And
banana? What is it? What's the case that you're describing?
So in India, there were several cases where there were, basically slaughters of a few people because a rumor spread in WhatsApp groups that, this man raped a child. And then the whole yeah, village, hundreds of people went after them, and most often it turned out to be fake. And it was just rumors spreading in these groups in a way that it didn't really, the context didn't join, or if somebody said, hey, I don't think that's true, it still spread to a different group and they didn't see that someone else said, hey, that's actually not true. So it was a huge case in India.
And it was also, I remember, interesting in research because there was a whole other layer of not everyone had access to a phone or had even like basic literacies, which means that the rumors spread from the WhatsApp groups, then like from mouth to mouth, which gave it like an extra layer of, hey, my neighbor Harry's. Yeah, sure, many Indians are called Harry, but you know what I mean, right? So it gave it like this, a trusted person told me, let's go lynch this man, and yeah, it was quite horrible.
Can I be the provocative person and say that it's the technology, right? Ooh. Yes, of course. It's because of the social media, right?
Yeah, of course. That's we never ever had this before. Like, witches were never burned.
No,
the sarcasm is heavy.
So, are you in camp? Technology is not the thing that we should be pointing towards?
No, I mean, technology is a tool. It's always, you know, technology is neither good nor bad, but it's also never neutral. So it's always going to be something people wield like a weapon to smack someone else down. Like, it's the guns don't kill people, but you know, why does the US have the highest rate of murders in the world? Like, it's one of those things. So yeah, it's I'm gonna give the academic nuanced answer where it's like, yes and no, technology is a lens through which we can look at problems, but it's never the only one.
But why is there always this techno panicky, moral panic, media panic, where we tend to talk about technology, new devices, new platforms or old platforms in slightly panicky way, that we're like, this is the root of all evil, this is going to be the downfall of humanity, this is why the kids are not all right, and so on. Where does this come from?
Do we have a day?
No, 10 minutes.
I mean, simple answer is that it's easy, but the easy answer is makes it easy. So it's, in a way, it's just, it gives for simple things to point at. This new thing arose and it occurred at the same time as, like, you know, society being in upheaval, so it must be the technology. Our children are being more insecure about their bodies, it must be the technology. Yes and no. So it's let's also not forget technology and social media did a lot of really cool things as well. Like, I still remember the techno optimism of 10, 15 years ago, and it was like, Arab Spring, yeah, look at the liberation. And like that really soured by now. Look how Egypt is not great right now. So it's always good and bad. And it's easy to point at technology because then you can also kind of say, ah, if we take away the technology, things will be better, right? So it's in a way, it's almost politically motivated to just have something to point at and to then just regulate into oblivion and hope that goes away instead of having to deal with social unrest, housing crises, worst inflation in years, the fact that climate change is going to bring so many problems to us. But yeah, let's just point at this information and say the people don't really know why they're angry, so they must be misinformed and poisoned by their mobile phones.
And if they would only have facts.
If only we could expose the people to facts, they wouldn't want to put the rich people on pitchforks.
What about, sorry to do this, but what about the kids? So I think whenever we talk about the effects of social media, then, and of course this is heavily researched as well, this whole like sharenting concept, right? So like parents who are heavily online as a parent, you know, this children that kind of become a part of it. There's of course more extreme examples like influencers, kids or kid bloggers, but also like if you think about the daily life of like a 7-year-old in 2024, most likely you are in the adult social media before you have your own social media anyways. You are in a room with adults who cannot put down TikTok. And hey, I'm also guilty of this. I'm not in any way saying this, but I'm just feeling like maybe this is something we should talk about more, because it gets mentioned that, you know, the Google XX and Mark Zuckerberg or whoever, they don't let their kids use smartphones or social media. And how much would you differentiate here, like a smartphone versus social media platforms? Like, should there be specific ones that we keep kids out of? What do you think?
we don't go easy on you.
No, but it's also when I this is the really difficult part, right? Because when I say technology is really not the main cause, it's almost as if I'm saying technology has no consequence whatsoever, and we are totally fine. Kids are not being completely dopamine addicted to the dopamine slot machines of society, or seeing their parents just sucked into a black hole of their mobile phone. So I think what you mentioned first of like the kids being exposed by their parents' behavior, that's a part that really deserves some regulation. And I've seen so many witnesses and testimonies of people, especially on TikTok, saying like, I was a child of a mommy blogger and I really did not consent to this. And it was awful. Every family holiday we had was a moment of like, and now for the content for the internet. So yeah, there's a whole generation with new traumas out there. And especially, I think in the US, there's a lot of conversation now about how, child labor laws should also apply to children that are being exposed for influencer content. So that's, I mean, there's several coins to this. There's kids being exploited for content. There's kids seeing their parents completely disappear in their mobile phones. There's kids being sucked up themselves and not understanding like how these addiction machines, you know, there is an addiction element to it. And then there's, of course, kids also not understanding like, wow, that's a huge world out there. It is not representative to my own world, nor is it something I need to necessarily comply with.
And also social media platforms and digital environments, they offer a lot of insight into how life is, what kind of norms do exist, how can I behave, who do I want to be, who I don't want to be, definitely. Yeah. So this part is probably overlooked.
Oh yeah, and I think this is one thing that really concerns me in the US, how they're now like the Child Safety Act and those kind of things. UK as well, the online kid safety bill, I'm screwing up the name, but where it's just very much on like, we must protect the children. It's like, cue Simpsons meme of like, what about the children?
Yeah.
we need to protect our children, of course, but what are you also taking away from them? And one thing I've seen in the discussion in the US is that they're like, we also must protect our children from the gender ideologies, which is terrifying, because a lot of kids who are discovering their sexuality do not have a safe place to do this in the offline world. So they find community online. A lot of the friends I have who discovered their sexuality, they actually managed to find community online and not feel so alone. So yeah, and also learn, of course, a lot of the basics of like, okay, this is where I can set my boundaries. This is how sexual intercourse
consent happens.
Exactly, all those things. So the internet, because the communities that it can form that you may not be able to find offline, is such an important element as well. And in wanting to restrict those spaces out of a sort of moral panic and fear of all like the scary monsters of the internet, what are you also taking away?
I was kind of baiting you to go to the point where I honestly personally feel that we have different things we do with those tools and platforms, but in general our problems are very similar no matter the age. The attention deficit that we will have, I really liked how you said dopamine slot machine of society. That's something I'm going to keep in mind. Because I'm also guilty. The fact that I think about these things and research these things doesn't mean I'm superhuman.
Also, you use the word guilty of these things, like you feel guilt about it, but what if that's the new normality? Like, what if that's what you need to train in yourself? What if the future is going to require this of you?
excessive media use and overload as a norm.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's this meme of like, it's XKCD where it's like, and now the World Reserve, Federal Reserve has decided that the new currency is the amount of funny pictures on your computer. And it's just like Rich. The guy goes like, I've been waiting for this day.
But indeed, that's the main thing that probably bothers us with technology as well, that it's change. And we are not very good with changing world. We want things to kind of be recognizable and so that I will know what to expect and I will understand the norms around it. But if there are all of these confusing new things and they're saying that I can't do these things that I'm used to anymore, they're canceling me for my behavior, then, you know, that can be a very confusing moment for older generations.
Yeah, and I absolutely empathize. At the same time, I feel like as a media literacy person, I cannot say anything besides you have to adapt, because there's no such thing as a final destination of now I'm media and information literate, because every time there's a new platform, like right now, AI literacy has, you know, became a really, really essential thing quite fast. Mm. You know, people didn't need to know what the Turing test was, but now I kind of need to remind them that, you know, this, you don't have
banana.
To do, okay. So Turing test is basically this theory from what, the 50s, 60s?
Yeah, Alan Turing.
Yeah, yeah. So, which is basically the main idea is that you can test whether or not you actually have artificial intelligence that can pass for a human. So the test means that the one who is doing the test cannot actually differentiate between a computer entity and a human entity. But as you already hear from my description, it's highly flawed, right? Because it's subjective. Like in 2022, there was this engineer in Google, Lemoine, I don't know how to pronounce his name, honestly. It's embarrassing. But I Google the man a lot, and I tell others to as well, because I feel like there is this interesting part where if an engineer works with a certain entity, let's say, for too long, I think he got attached, and that's why he wanted to believe that it had passed the Turing test. So the Turing test is something that we need to kind of remind everyone that ChatGPT doesn't have to be like, you don't have to say, hello, ChatGPT, please help me, and hope that it will save you from...
I'm always very rude to ChatGPT. I will not survive the AI revolution.
Exactly. But, you know, everyone seems to have it in mind, because the hype is a lot bigger and louder, and even the hype by OpenAI is a lot louder and bigger than the computer scientists who are like, this is not artificial intelligence, really.
It's machine learning.
So we're all grandmas who are going to Google like, hello, Mr. Google, please, can you give me the bus times? Right? We're doing all of that.
But I have colleagues who really genuinely use ChatGPT as their new search engine. Not to look up new information, but it's just like their go-to for everything. And I've kind of become, it's handy because it thinks with you. So it just does a bit of an analysis thinking part with you, instead of just like going, well, you may find it somewhere on this trashy website from 10 years ago.
Snapchat AI is a really popular search tool amongst the younger generation.
Oh, that's the first I've heard of Snapchat.
And the reason, I think it was our practitioners on the field who told us this. And it's worrisome, because I used to think, and the last report said, that the youth is especially good, because even if they get their information from Snapchat or TikTok, then they have the habit of going to Google to check. Mm-hmm. But with Snapchat AI, no one said they check anything anymore, because it's presented fast in a convenient way and you don't have to leave the platform even. So again, nuance, right? It can be a really, really good tool, but if you only rely on it, then it can also kind of be probably problematic.
We're really lazy, usually human beings.
No. We're not lazy. We are energy efficient.
Yes, we are energy efficient beings. So that makes a lot of sense that the young ones and the old ones are not leaving the platforms that are their like domesticated environments. So of course, if you're on TikTok and you want some more information, then you search on TikTok. Or if you're on Instagram, then you will mostly get your info from the same kind of system. So the platform design, how the platforms are built up, is extremely important in what they even allow us to imagine because, you know, it's not God-given structure, it's man-made structure. So there are all sorts of biases, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think when it comes to what you were saying about, like, we need to also teach AI literacy with media literacy, I think one that we really need to teach is algorithmic literacy as well.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole, I mean, when we did interviews on, like, news doubters, especially with the younger generation, we were like, where do you see the news? And it was just like, the news comes to me. They do not go search for news. So they're just like, no, my information ecosystem is kind of built out in a way. But then when you really dig into it, it's like, okay, but which news sources are you then exposed to? And there's not a big awareness of like, ah, yes, I followed these and these so that I could get these and these diverse things. And especially when it comes to encountering misinformation, disinformation, when I ask, like, do you go look for a fact check? It's like, no, I'll probably encounter it again, like the correction. And it's like, wow, okay, how are you actually, you know, working with your algorithms for this? Do you understand these platforms in a way that that information will come to you? Or are you just kind of like expecting that to happen because it may have happened in the past? So there's an element of algorithmic literacy that's necessary for people to really understand, like, are you just putting faith in this platform to just like dig up information for you? Because you might get surprised in that case.
One thing that really broke our heart was when our colleague was going from kindergarten to play with children. And in this play, they would talk about digital media and social media and all of these kinds of platforms. And one thing that was really heartbreaking to hear was that very many young children believe in grown-ups. So when they are talking about false information, and they believe that if something is really harmful and really wrong on social media, then the grown-ups will get to it.
Mm. Especially about TikTok.
Yeah. Yes.
That's awful.
And that
but you're supposed to believe in grown-ups, though, if they can't even rely on... I mean, I know we every generation gets more pessimistic, but isn't it sad that we have entire generations that we need to tell them, like, do not rely on your elders?
Never, ever. The system is broken. Like,
You're six now. It's time for you to learn. Grow up. The system is deeply flawed.
I feel like this is a great bridge
to the next segment.
To our next segment, where we ask you, Natalie, to tell us in a couple of minutes, but in like rather simple terms, about a study that you have conducted or are just planning out, or something that you are doing in research. And after you have given the little 1-2 minute talk, we will later play this for a 10-year-old who will then take the most important golden nuggets from that and tell us how he kind of felt about the text and what did he take away from this.
So for my own PhDs, this is not super related to this info, but it is related to like the platforms and just the way that the humans interact on them. I'm looking at climate change communities, so people who engage with climate change content and who are worried about what's happening in the world and what they can do. And I interviewed a bunch of people on Instagram and Twitter who are, you know, doing something on climate change with, you know, people with a lot of followers, people with really not a lot of followers, people who, you know, interact a lot and they post a lot, and people who just, you know, sometimes look and they just like here and there. And I asked them kind of, how do you see on these two platforms, what is your community? Who are the people that you feel safe with? Who are the people that you feel like you can tell, like, oh, I don't think I agree with what you said there. And who are the people that when they tell you, oh, that's really not okay to say here, that you would accept when they say that. And so I did those kind of questions and interviews to kind of understand what we call social norms, which is kind of the unspoken of rules that we have on like what is good behavior and what is bad behavior. And like there is no general social norm. Like society has a bunch of social norms. And so I was curious to see on Instagram and Twitter what those social norms in climate change communities were and how exactly they were actually different on Instagram and Twitter. So how exactly there people felt a bit different about how they were being corrected and that they could correct a social norm. And so I'm still doing that analysis of my results. But I did find on Instagram, people really had far less of those kind of conflicts. They were just like, oh, it's just, you know, me and my community, me and my followers. And because you have a lot more like this DM culture, like sending people direct messages on Instagram, people would way more often just send a DM to say like, hey, I don't think that's correct. Or maybe you didn't notice that this was, I don't know, fatphobic or this forgot indigenous people or those kind of things. Whereas on Twitter, people were a lot more like, yeah, okay, so I've been corrected about this. And then I have fights with this group and I see this in group and this out group. So there was a lot more of this on Twitter, like a kind of splitting up of groups really in a way on this kind of social norm lines of people saying, yeah, so I agree with these people on how we should tackle climate change, but I don't at all like how their tone. I don't like how they just like, you know, attack climate deniers or engage with them in a way. So it's really like, okay, you see them as your same community, but you actually kind of distance yourself just because you don't really share the same norms of communication. So that was kind of, yeah, where I'm at. And it's part of my broader PhD research where I'm trying to understand like how are those architectures, the way that the platform is built, how does that have an impact on our social norm conversations?
Hi, Iko.
Hi.
We meet again. So Nathalie told us about her research. First, how did you like how she speaks?
Who am I to judge her speaking? But I guess I understood pretty well from this. Pretty good. Or not even pretty good. Very good.
But about the content, what did you understand? What do you remember? What does Nathalie study?
So, I don't know if it's the correct word, but like toxicity between platforms, like which platforms, let's say Twitter and Instagram, which were mentioned in here. What people engage more in, like social media fights, as she told, in Instagram there's more like direct messaging and DMing and just saying like, oh, I don't think that that's correct, but in Twitter it's like fights with big groups and, oh, hey, you, like, if somebody, I think it's disinformation, not even misinformation, because misinformation is more forgivable, but then there's gonna be like big fights.
Why do you think it's important to study this?
Because one, if we wouldn't study this, there wouldn't be a cool podcast episode of this. And also I feel like we could see which people are like more active in social media activism and climate, especially climate activism mentioned in here.
Mm-hmm. Have you been fighting over social norms in games or social media?
Yeah, I guess.
How?
Well, let me think. I feel like in some Roblox games, some people are like really say like bad things, and then I say and then first of all report them always, the trolls and stuff, and second of all I mainly just said like, why are you doing this and please stop and like stuff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you too.
Okay, so now it's time to nerd out.
Time to nerd out. And honestly, I would want to continue with what you just started, kind of, because there's a lot of nuggets here. I feel like maybe people might be questioning still. So first of all, social norms in the context of platforms architecture and how it all influences both the social norms, but like it's kind of like influencing each other, right?
Yeah.
So can you just talk a little bit more about that? How did you even come about, first of all? Like, how did you come about this research topic? How did you get to randomly spitting out that?
So the year was 2008. No. I find social norms very interesting because they're these hidden, unwritten rules, and usually you only find out about a social norm when you crash your head into a wall and someone is correcting you. You're like, oh, I had no idea. And so I've been a child of the internet, just kind of been on a lot of forums and like Reddit, and I always thought it was, you know, I'm very open extroverted person in real life, but online I've always been a bit like, I don't know what the norms are, what am I allowed to say here? So I've always been more of like a watcher and a lurker to kind of get the sense of what is good and what is bad. So I always thought it was very interesting, like why I feel more comfortable in some spaces than in others. So that's kind of where it came from, my personal interest in social norms. And to kind of explain a bit, you know, the differences, I think there's these platforms that have an actual like boundary around a group, like a sort of like, okay, I'm either in the group or I'm out of the group. For example, on Reddit, you have like a subreddit and it has very clear rules. The norms are kind of written out. So you can kind of see like, okay, this isn't allowed. And if you post something that doesn't really fit it, you quite often get like an automated message saying, oh, sorry, this goes against our community rules. And the same with like a WhatsApp group. You have like an actual boundary around that. And what I find interesting about that is like, who manages to enforce that kind of norm, right? Is it just other people? Is it just like a you know, one for all survival, you know, Lord of the Flies situation? Or is it, you know, a few community polices that tell you, who have like some sort of hierarchy? And so depending on the platform, you have different community polices because that's how the platform is shaped. On WhatsApp, you have a moderator and they have actual more access. They can kick you out of the group while other people cannot. They can only complain like, oh, what's this person still doing in this group? whereas on a platform like Instagram or Twitter, there is no real community police. But there are people with more influence, people who have more followers who can then really enforce a norm by saying like, this person right here, you know. And I had this also in my interviews, someone on Instagram who, I mean, they didn't put it in those words, but they really, really didn't like other big influencers handing out flights as a kind of like, oh, today giveaway is a flight to Bali. And so they would go share it in their stories to all their followers, say like, this influencer is part of the problem. And so that person would then get like hundreds of messages because the person I interviewed was like, I think it's necessary that we let them know this is not a good norm. Mm-hmm. So that's not, you know, there's no community police in the sense of that influencer doesn't have features and possibilities to kick that person out, but they do have a bigger influence because of their following to enforce a norm. So there's all these little elements that in daily life are a lot more, I think, simplified, whereas online you have so many more dimensions to social norm enforcement. But I'm still figuring it out in many, many ways. So you're along for the ride with me.
Because in physical spaces, we can do all of these kind of like micro things to show that you're breaking norm here. Like I could be, yeah, crossing my arms. I could be giving you a dirty look. I could be like whispering something to my friend. And you would get that you have done something that doesn't fit my understanding of the norm. Mm-hmm. But in digital spaces, the tiny little remarks are not present even. Like there is no like a warning, like kind of like, ew, that kind of look.
And even silence can be interpreted in so many different ways, right? It's like, am I being silenced? Like, is it the algorithm? Is it just my friend is busy?
And it's been like this, like for a long, long time before social media platforms were a thing, right? Because emojis and all of these, like, you know, visualized emotion, like, why would we need them other than you didn't get what I was saying? So let me
love emojis so much. And I have such a big problem with people like, that's not very professional. Like, no, shit emoji. Rolling eye emoji.
I used the smiley face for passive aggressive emails.
No, you're ruining it for everyone.
I'm using the smiley face everywhere just to create chaos.
No, but it's very interesting.
Wait,
though.
Wait, though. Banana. What's wrong with using a smiley face?
Okay,
please
so
tell us.
The context can be taken in several ways. So going back to Laswell's model of communication. No, sorry. Just joking. But, you know, it does really rely on the same thing that you cannot really expect that the receiver of the message always gets it in the same context. So some of the people who I send a passive-aggressive sentence with a smiley at the end will think that I'm actually being friendly. Friendly. But a lot of the people, especially
scum
the ones,
scum of the earth.
But a lot of the people, especially the ones who might not be so, like, might not use emojis themselves or might not know these connotations, might see it as, you know, like, might immediately see it as something that is attacking them, vice versa, right? So basically, it's kind of like the baklajan emoji or the star emoji, or the, like, these things have different connotations. The star emoji is for porn stars.
Oh, and what's the baklajan?
Eggplant.
Eggplant. Isn't that the same thing?
No, it's not.
Oh. No, eggplant is, unlike banana, is one of those words that has a completely different name in almost every language.
Yep. Pommu in Estonian.
Aubergine.
Pommu.
Melanzana in Italian.
Where did we just end up? We're going to have to cut this. So the short answer really is that the passive-aggressive smiley will be understood by some as passive-aggressiveness, and by others they will think it's a sincere smile. It's going back to I still love the word Voldemorting. So basically hiding your true intentions with either pre-agreed upon codes or, why not, emojis, right? So using any type of emoji in a context that is not immediately understood in the same way by everyone is really already kind of like poking someone in understanding what's their online culture. Like, are we on
but
the same page?
Where did we come from?
Yeah, I can circle us back because I do have a question. Like, why do you use this if somebody doesn't understand, unless you have an audience? And the audience part is, for me, where the social norm part comes in. Because if you use this for, you know, in a passive aggressive way, for someone who didn't get to, like, hey, this emoji is very passive aggressive, I would understand if you do that in front of an audience who gets like, oh yeah, Maya's being passive aggressive, look at the smiley,
screenshot the ability at later stages, or just for yourself. Yeah, like, you're feeling really frustrated and you can't really do anything.
That's
because
after,
the social norm
exactly.
is be polite, but you put that smiley there and you're
so
like,
I delete
I
what I really wanted to say. And I leave the smiley. So that's basically it.
That's self-care.
It's the nicer way of approaching it because, yeah.
But so you social are needs. Focusing in your research not on the decoding part, like how people interpret, but rather the group behavior, the not nudging. Nudging is not a word for you.
To explain nudging,
affordances is yours.
Yes.
Yours. Your frame is affordances.
Only me. I have completely appropriated the concept of affordances.
But tell us, because affordances is not used by all of our listeners as a grounding theory.
Yeah, I really love the concept of affordances. So it's what the environment lets you do. So it's the example I often give is like a doorknob lets you open the door. So it affords you so many different things. It affords you heat preservation because the door might keep the cold out. It affords you security because you can lock it. And it affords you many different things if you have a very creative mind. Like, it can become a weapon if you like pull it out and you like beat someone with it. So it's so many things that our environment affords us to do, and also affords us to do differently. For example, if you are a very short person or a child, then the chairs we are sitting on does not really afford that person to actually sit because they can't really reach it. So it's really about the action potential of an object, of a thing. And so platforms have affordances too. If I, you know, like something, if that's a little hard, back in the day, Twitter likes were stars. And when they changed that from a star to a heart, there was such an upheaval because people are like, but that's not how I, that's not what the
I don't love it.
Yeah,
I just want to mark it.
They were like, but the star afforded me a way different behavior than the heart. Like the star for a lot of people was like, it's something I will, you know, they didn't have bookmarks yet. So it was just like, oh, I'm just going to save this for later. Just like, I have seen this. Just does not get my approval. I have just seen this. Well, now if you like something, I've had it before that people are like, you like this tweet and it was really mean. It's like, I mean, they had good points. Like, I didn't agree with all of it. So it, the affordance of that like has many, many different action potentials. So it affords you different behavior.
How do you study this? With which methods?
By asking people.
So you go online interviewing?
So I for my climate change research, I interviewed people online or offline if I could find them in my physical vicinities. But yeah, you really just ask them. You just go like, okay, well, what does this mean for you? When somebody sends you a DM, how does that feel? When there is an audience, you know, when you somebody reacts in a comment on a post on Instagram versus reacts in a DM, how do you interpret that? But it's difficult. Eh? Like, it's also there's a lot of research on like perceived affordances, because we can, you know, there's discussion on saying like, every object has a limited amount of affordances. That's just it, you know? The example I gave with the doorknob, you know, you're not supposed to use it as a weapon. So it's like, these are the intrinsic affordances. But there's also perceived affordances. And that's also why when you design a platform, there's so many ways in which humans will use it that you maybe had not really predicted.
Do you have a good example on that where it was designed in one way, but then people came along and they ruined everything and they started using the platform or the functionalities in completely different ways?
Oh, there's so many examples. I think one that I thought was interesting was, you guys have heard of Clubhouse? It was, you know, very brief, like, you know, like Be Real, like a moment of like, the new app. And it was like the podcasting app. And they had, I thought, an interesting feature to deal with like moderation and blocking and flagging. So what they said was, okay, if you don't like someone entering your podcast, your room, I think they were calling it in Clubhouse, you can flag them and they get like a mark of like a black mark of death or something. But other people can take over your flags as well and say like, well, I trust Maria to have good judgment, so I'm just going to take over all the flag people that
like
she has.
Like a social credit system of it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so what happened, of course, is I think it was Taylor Lorenz, the journalist from, back then New York Times, now Washington Post, and she's not very well liked on the internet. And so she was at some point not able to enter any Clubhouse room because a lot of people just kept taking over the flags without really realizing. So it's one of those features like, this could have worked in the sense of like, I trust Maria to have a good judgment and I don't want to do all the work myself. But then the block lists get shared along and all of a sudden it is used as a harassment technique to exclude someone or a specific group of someone.
And it's the dark practices. Mm-hmm. It's the dark ones. Also, didn't OnlyFans start out as a
Patreon,
music?
I think it was. Patreon was definitely for writers in the beginning as well.
Yeah, and OnlyFans was for musicians,
yeah.
I think.
And then they got took over, both of them.
But then people started using it for...
Because they had really good functionality for audiovisual. So why would you make good functionality for audiovisual if you don't want people to get naked and show each other? I mean, we're just monkeys like in a jungle after all.
The internet is for porn. The internet is for porn.
It's not an easy life being a porn researcher. We have so many memes. We have to start separate page or something.
Rule 34.
Yeah, rule 34. Banana.
If it exists, there is porn of it.
And rule 35.
But I don't know that one.
If it doesn't exist, there will be porn about it.
Props to you.
Okay, now I think it's somewhat sad feeling to leave the science now and go to the human side, but also, Nathalie, you are studying so many different things that we would need several seasons of podcasts to cover everything. So we have to like drop this now because we want to know more about you too. Ooh.
So the year was
Maya, you are the best person for this segment always.
I love the intro question Maria has written out as well, Nathalie, because we obviously have talked with you before. So Maria just wrote down, how did you become the fabulous you? Which I think is a fair question, but we are fangirling pretty hard. But maybe we can start off with how we became aware of your existence.
Ooh, yes,
because we
yes.
haven't talked about that yet at all. So we started fangirling you on Instagram. We just knew there was like a crazy Belgian researcher who just, you know, there is this understanding that researchers need to be like very distantly observing rather than intervening and being like, hey, this is actually not true. But indeed, that's what you did with the account Anti-Conspiracy Meme Wars. And this is probably why we have talked about memes so much, so we maybe should have started with that we
nah, actually let them guess.
But can you please tell us, how did that account come about, and how has that influenced everything after?
So the year was 2020. It was the pandemic, and as everyone, I was sitting at home frustrated, mostly frustrated that I wasn't able to do anything, that I was just like, you know, not able to contribute to us being able to fight this pandemic. And you should know, before the pandemic started, I had already delved deep into anti-vaxxer groups and on Facebook and Reddit, because I thought it was so fascinating. Like, holy shit, there's a whole group of humans who have completely dismissed one of the greatest evolutions, like one of the greatest inventions of modern age, vaccines. So I already thought it was super fascinating. And back then I was already like, oh, wow, we're really in for a world of trouble. But I thought it as a slow decline and of group immunity, because this is what was happening. People weren't taking like the measles vaccines and even polio vaccines. And then the pandemic happened. I was like, oh, my God. So I could see it coming from afar. And I think it was like the summer of 2020 when it really started kicking off the disinformation around COVID. I think it was a lot of people who had a hard time coping.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of research. And you guys probably talk to people about this as well, about how, you know, the most anxious people about the pandemic just flipped. And they were like, you know what? Maybe none of this is actually happening. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was basically what was kind of happening. And I noticed on Instagram, there was really just like a hole, an emptiness of actual, you know, people with good content and not just there to show off their body or sell, you know, branded stuff. And those people who were had a lot of followers. And for some reason, turned into conspiracists. So I was like, okay, I need to do something. And that's where my meme stash came in. As I said, the currency suddenly became valuable. So what I did was I just posted memes that I had that kind of pushed for critical reflection on conspiracies and on trust in science. And like, one of the memes I really like is like, you don't have to, blindly trust governments and scientists, but why would you then blindly trust some charlatan selling bullshit to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's one of those, it's actually not even a meme if you think about it. It's just like a good quote. It's just a good way of reflecting. And so I just shared them from the idea of let me try to contribute and give people some tools, because a meme is a really good tool to start a conversation and to spread a message. So yeah, that's where that really came from. And when the pandemic started kind of running its course and most people got vaccinated, then Ukraine war started. And I tried to also kind of intervene on that, but it wasn't really my context, to be honest. And it was really difficult also with the propaganda. And especially because Russian disinformation has a really... They're really good at also including an element of truth in it.
Exactly, yeah.
Which made it really hard for me because, like... I'm not a NATO fangirl at all. Like, I'm very, very critical of U.S. Military and imperialism and stuff. But at some point, I was accused of being a NATO shill. And I was like, oh, my God, no, I can't do this.
So you quieted down on the account, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was also, you know, I was really like, maybe it's time I invested my energy in my PhD.
So you were not doing your PhD in the beginning of the pandemic.
No,
so
no.
How did that come about? Tell us.
Ooh, well... I always wanted to do a PhD when I was younger, but let me open my baggage. I discovered I have ADHD when I was in 2019, and it was such a like, this explains so many things. and it also explained why I have such a hard time focusing and reading. And, you know, the diagnosis really gave me the push I needed to like, okay, I think I can do this. You know, mm-hmm. I think I can tackle this. I just needed funding and it wasn't that easy. And then kind of during the pandemic, I just took a leap. I had a really nice supervisor that I found at the Brussels University. And he was like, you know what, Natalie, if you want, like, just get started already and like, we'll figure it out. And then my contract at the think tank I was working at also was going to end. Like, I could have renewed it, but I was like, you know what, I'm ready for something new as well. I was working on cybersecurity, and I was also really interested in the online culture part, the information security element. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, it's time for a switch. I don't know, the pandemic, some people went a bit crazy. I think it just gave me the courage to just make a leap. So that's when I started doing my PhD, but I had the account already. I don't know, it's still odd how I had like 40,000 followers, but it's for me just like, this was weird, okay. You know?
It was a phase.
It was, you know, some people baked sourdough bread. I became an influencer during the pandemic.
You said cybersecurity. Mm. You're going to have to banana this a little bit. So,
banana this.
I mean, banana this in the context that if you say I'm a cybersecurity expert, that could mean you working on very different things. So what did you actually work on as a cybersecurity expert?
Yeah, I wasn't technical. So I was really more involved in like the policy stuff. So I used to work at the Belgian Cybersecurity Center, where we were looking at like, how can we secure the country? What is needed to secure the country? So I was in charge of like providing trainings for our government employees to make sure that everybody who was working on critical stuff had the correct training. So I was really there to identify like, okay, these people need network security. These people need to know how to report cybercrime, what artifacts to store. So I needed some technical knowledge, but most of it was just like shuffling around budgets and just like gathering the right people around the table. And then after that, I worked on European cybersecurity. And that was more diplomacy. So we were looking at it from like a really global perspective of like, how can we make sure that everybody kind of tries to not attack each other in the world? Or if they really want to, that they, you know, don't target hospitals and those kind of things. Let there be rules, but let the rules also not suffocate the internet and give countries the legitimacy to... fragment the internet because, you said we needed to secure our cyberspace. We secured our cyberspace.
Mm-hmm. What did you study in uni to know all of this? Or is it like mostly self-taught stuff?
Internet.
I have a secret for you.
I come from the internet.
No, I studied political sciences. And then I had, I was not a great student, but I had this one course in my third year that really just like opened my eyes. I was like, this is what I like. This is what I want to do.
What was it?
It was, what was the name again? It was Just War Theory. So it was about the ethics of war. And it was, this professor who really just liked it. It wasn't really a regular curriculum.
Give a shout out.
It was Bruno Kopetisch, and he... Go Peters, god damn it. I have a friend who had the same supervisor and she kept saying his name wrong. And it's stuck with me now. Do not go Peters. And he was really, really kind. And he supervised my first thesis as well. And he really gave me the confidence. Like, he was, I did my first thesis not on cyber. It was on drone warfare. Mm. So also technology based and like technology in society. And the ethics of drone warfare in Pakistan, which, you know, Pakistan.
Spoiler, probably no ethics, no?
I mean, the thing is, oh, that's a whole other topic, but it's, war has certain rules and ethics, and like, there is a way to have just warfare. So you have to have a just cause, you have to have proportionality, you have to have like a legitimate authority, all of those things. Like, it's kind of, it stems from Christian tradition for some reason. Hmm. But there's a lot of like political thinkers in the past, you know, centuries who've thought about like what makes war just. And the thing with indeed Pakistan was it wasn't just because the US had a war in Afghanistan, which also debatable, but targeting Pakistan. Pakistan was not even
a part of the conflict.
Of the conflict, but since it was a war on terrorism and the terrorist insurgents would cross the border, for the US it was justified. But so that's where international law comes in, and also where the norms come back in.
Okay. And for your master's thesis?
And so that was my master's thesis, and I did two masters. Okay. The second master was on cyber war.
Two masters, right.
Yeah, because
right. You nerd.
Because in the first one it was like, okay, 90% of this I do not care for. I only cared for the war stuff. Or
War.
We're laughing too hard at really serious topics, but it's a coping mechanism.
You gotta laugh. But then the second master was only, it was called Law and Politics of International Security. And it was about this whole idea of like security, and this is where it kind of come back into the social media elements, is security is a mindset, it's a feeling, and it's something you kind of decide on collectively what is and isn't allowed. And so we have international law, but international law is very political. And so it's the same with the norms. If somebody breaches international law and nobody responds to it or corrects it, that sets precedent. And so, you know, the US invading Iraq set precedent for Ukraine getting invaded by Russia, because if they can do it, why can't we? So it's all of those things kind of combining into one, where it's really states are as much children in the schoolyard as, where norms apply and where there's rules. But if nobody enforces them, then there are no rules.
Are you doing what you thought you were going to be doing as a child? I don't mean like, did you play war games? But I think
we did actually.
Yeah, you did. But also about like, were you already interested in how these group norms even played out as a child or so? Like,
as a 5-year-old?
Did you have your little finger up in the air and you already had a little bug saying, I want to be a researcher? Or has this all kind of been like, it seems like it's been more of a natural process than like a career path that you decided on
like
very young?
Like a river finding its way off the mountain.
Like we are doing here with the podcast. We're going backwards now. Did you notice?
I did it on purpose even.
Nice. I feel a lot of structure in this podcast though. No, when I was, I mean, I didn't have a lot of friends when I was a kid. Like, I was that kid that was like, the internet. So it was more, I was always interested in conflict, I think, stemming from some stuff that happened in my childhood as well. And so it's always been interesting to see, like, how do people try to resolve it? And, you know, how what are the factors, the intermediating factors? 'Cause you can look at it from just personalities. I'm remaining vague on purpose a little bit here. But there's a lot of elements to how we resolve conflict and which people refuse to comply with rules and what kind of measures you take when they don't.
But you haven't dedicated yourself only to conflict. There is this other big part there, the media. So has media always played a big role in your life? Can you maybe remember the first time that you were truly influenced in a positive or negative way by media, in whichever form you want to talk about?
I mean, it was really the internet. And I think, I mean, the references I make, I was really on 4chan a lot when I was a kid. And those kind of...
Banana?
4chan is sometimes also described as the sewage of the internet.
Rotten.com and 4chan.
Yes, yes. It was not a good place to be as a kid or a teenager, but it fit my dark and moody childness. And also, I saw 4chan evolve a lot into something different. And I think it's really interesting how 4chan used to be just a very self-deprecating place. It used to be a place where it was completely anonymized, by the way. So you really had no idea who these other people were. It could have all literally just been one person. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But it was just very much like, oh, you know, you mean nothing. Like, go kill yourself. It was not a good place. But it was also, people made very dark humor, inappropriate jokes. And it was just all like, oh, you're going to hell for this, Anon. Like, it was just, people were very aware that it was not a good place. And there was also, I think, I forgot which rules. So those rules of the internet that we just been, they come from 4chan. And there was also a rule, like, there are no girls on the internet. And I felt that. I was just like, I am anonymous here. Nobody knows. I am a girl.
So a forum child, for sure.
Yeah, and it was funny. I think sometimes I didn't get really radicalized because I'm a woman. And I always felt like, I don't really belong here.
It could have gone the other way.
Who knows? I know. I don't know. I think there is also an element, and this is where I think the change in 4chan happened, and this is where the norms also come in. When there used to be this feeling of like, hey, this is inappropriate humor, like, you know, very racist, dark humor. I still have a whole repertoire of dead baby jokes, like, mm-hmm. It's, you know, but it used to really be like, we were all aware, like, this is actually not okay. I felt, at mm-hmm. least, I was aware, like, in this context, in this space, it's allowed, but we know it's actually not okay. Yep. And it kind of flipped around 2015 when there became a new board on 4chan, a poll about politics. And it was all of a sudden like, no, this is okay. Like, this is a political thought and ha ha ha, we're laughing with black people. But actually,
yeah.
And that's really, I mean, I wasn't really on 4chan that much by that time, but I remember going back there and being like, holy shit, what happened here?
You say that it happened around 2015. That's quite recent, right?
Yeah.
Because very many of the things that you described, they were the early internet.
So the flip happened around that time. Mm-hmm. And maybe it happened earlier. I'm not a great 4chan historian. There's some mm-hmm. really, really interesting research done at, especially at UvA, like the Dutch, the Amsterdam University. So they're much more informed about it.
We will add links to our link tree.
And we can really wrap up this segment saying you were obsessed with invisible norms on 4chan, and now you became a researcher of social norms.
Yes.
How beautiful.
And now we near the end of our podcast episode, so it's time to love bomb. We've already started a little bit, given a little bit of a shout out here and there. But now, do you have, and I'm sure that you do, but who do you have in the research, in teaching, in your expert field that you kind of admire, that they are so awesome?
Oh my god, this almost feels like my PG acknowledgement. Like, I don't know if there's any PG students listening, but you must do this as well when you're writing. It's like, oh, I need to thank these people. I need to, you know, you're trying to fall asleep, but this is hard because you're putting me on the spot here.
I know, and there will be people who are left out and who will track you down and be like, 100%. I heard you didn't say my name.
All the years I put in.
100%. No, I think that the people I 100% need to thank are really at the VUB, my colleagues, and it's just my supervisor. I have three supervisors. It grew. They just kept expanding.
Multiplying.
Because my funding was so convoluted, and it was just like, oh, here's another project that we can fund you on, but you get a new supervisor.
Messy.
So it was really the first supervisor who really just believed in me, you know. That's
say the name.
Jo Pearson. Sorry, thank you. And then there's Trisha Meyer from the CD2I, the Brussels School of Governance, who just, you know, she's just such a forgiven, that's not the primary word I would give her. Like, she's just such a motivated and open and brilliant scholar as well.
How do they do it? Because if I want to model myself after these people that get all the love and I want to be a good supervisor, perhaps, what do they do?
I saw a really great meme of like, there's enough smart people in academia. Distinguish yourself by being kind.
Yeah.
And that's these people, you know, like they're just very much like, listen, I'm not here to be like, you know, in the history books, even though I think they will be. But I'm here to really just be supportive. And that's, I mean, it's in my whole career, there have been a few people like that. But it's been astounding how much they're willing to really lift you up, you know. And it's the same for my third supervisor, Ike Picone. It's just all such a brilliant scholar, you know, people I can really bounce ideas off of, and who just, you know, they get it, they see it, and they're willing to just kind of make time for me, which is on its own already like fabulous. I know you said love bombing. It's just amazing. And because people tell me a lot, like, oh, academia is so toxic. And it's like, I mean, maybe, but I've been a bit spoiled, I guess, maybe, at the VUB. Like, and the fourth person is really Peter Ballon, and he's our director of our institute, and now became the vice rector of research as well, of the university. And he was also the one who was like, we're going to find money for you. And I was like, wow. Because at first I was like, but where, and what am I expected to do back? And he at some point sat me down and was like, Natalie, you just do your research and we'll figure it out, okay? And it was just like such a relief to not have to worry about money all the time, because mm-hmm. that was really the first 2 years. It was mm-hmm. because I took that leap and I never regretted it, but it was stressful. Also, I have no idea what I'm going to do after the PhD, so I hope to be able to thank some people. Some new people on that list.
It's the stream. Yeah.
Oh, and then the fifth person, sorry. Yeah, the fifth person I want to thank, would like to thank me. No. No, it's Christoph Busch from the Hannah Arendt Institute, because it's this new institute that they created between universities where they try to valorize research for society. And it's close to what you guys are doing as well with the media literacy, but they really want to make sure that the research that we do is made valuable for, you know, how society's polarizing. And so they actually funded my first year because we had funding to create moderator e-learnings for local administrations. So I went with them. We gave a bunch of trainings for really people who are in villages, like, so there's a whole fight on our Facebook group. Yeah. You know, these local groups. And it's you know, I you know, one of the advices I give them is like, this is an online space that has different hierarchies, and you need to find those like parallel mayors of the online spaces and just call them out for their responsibilities. And I mean, this is one of the things, but so Christoph Busch is, I really am grateful also for his insights and the way that he conducts this center and just really sees how, you know, important it is to not stay in this ivory tower and to bring that research down to society.
Yes. And we end with a very simple question. How to fix the world?
Being kind. You said simple answer, so I think being kind is an important one.
It is.
Maya's not believing it.
Well, it's important, but, you know, it got a bit soppy in the end, honestly, to my taste. What about disinformation?
You can't make me do this after, like, love bombing, and you're like, all right, let's get back to...
No, okay. But one finishing sentence, not how to fix the world, but how to give massive amounts of copium to everyone so we can handle disinformation waves and avalanches coming our way.
I think it's really about giving agency back to people instead of corporations. And this is my anti-capitalism speaking, but just not letting greed win. And this is also what I mean by being kind. It's about trying to live together as a society instead of one for each. And this is where why the social norms is such a big thing for me, because it's really about how we as society, as collectives, try to survive. Like, it's, you know, people think, oh, Darwin was like survival of the fittest. No, our main survival strategy was cooperation.
So it's good to be kind if you want to live and get scraps of food when you're sick, right?
Yes.
That's well, maybe better note to end than just be kind. So not just be kind for the sake of it, but be kind because it's strategically logical in a human society.
That's a way to look at it.
Thank you guys very much for being with us. Thank you, Maya, and thank you, Natalie. And we will meet again through the
interwebs.
Interwebs as well. Series of tubes. So thank you very much, and we're out.